Forever Dog.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writer's Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh yeah!
Before we get to today's episode, I have an exciting chat with the writer and director of Beckett, which is out right now on Netflix. Everyone should go watch it. Pause this right now, go watch it, because we're gonna get into it. And I really love the movie, so I'm excited to talk to these guys. I'm gonna have you introduce yourselves on the microphones so the listener knows what you sound like. And Kevin, let's start with you, please.
This is Kevin A. Rice, writer on Beckett.
Thank you.
And I'm Ferdinando Cito Filomarino, director of Beckett.
Congrats on the movie, guys. It's really fun and it's really exciting and it has something to say about the world, which is nice for a thriller. Let's just talk about how it started to come together. I'm sure you've told the story a million times, so feel free to give me the abridged version, but how did this movie take shape?
Ferdy, I think it started with a shrimp salad. Is that where you and I came together?
Yeah, well, I always loved this genre, or let's say this subgenre of like the manhunt thriller with a political background very much. Whether it was in literature in the first half of the 20th century or in movies more in the second half of the 20th century, thinking of the 70s in particular. And I kind of always knew I wanted to make something along those lines. And, and then the idea was, okay, but how do I find an angle? What could be the priorities of this one? What can be fresh about it? And the angle was character and tone. You know, what if there inside of this thriller is a dramatic character who's not supposed to be in a thriller? And therefore that informed automatically the tone had to be somewhat grounded. And on those premises, I started sort of throwing together a kind of story. And I wanted to collaborate with an American writer because, you know, this genre is very much explored in American, in American cinema. It's kind of the archetype, you know, an American in a foreign place figuring things out. So I wanted to play on that and then find our angle. And I like the idea with my background, I'm Italian, I'm a European filmmaker, to work with an American writer with his background. And, through my producers, I came across Kevin's material and he wrote something that I read, which was a different genre. But I remember reading, even though that was sci-fi actually, some very tangible characters who felt real, even though sci-fi stuff was happening. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So, and he responded to whatever I wrote at that time, which was, of course, very early on. Mm-hmm. And so based on this mutual sort of reaction, we met in front of a shrimp salad in Los Angeles.
It all comes back.
Started talking about all the things that the movie could be. And then, you know, it was the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
So yeah. Kevin, what were you doing up until now? Am I right that this is your first produced credit?
First produced credit, yeah. So in that, and Ferdy, the lunch Ferdy mentioned was sort of at the very beginning of my, like, you know, so I think I was still working at, so I'll just give you a quick background, but
yeah,
I worked at, I came into LA to go to AFI, the Film Institute, for the writing program. Subsequently, I was just working at UCLA and UCLA Santa Monica, the doctor's office, and I would write in the cafeteria after I left work to avoid traffic because I lived on the east side. And so from that, I'd written the pilot in that cafeteria that Ferdy read that, like, I think at that point had been sold at that point. So when in development, kind of just didn't go any further than that. But yeah, and then so I was with WME at the time and they put us together and we had this lunch and we very clicked. And I think that was about 7 years ago, I think, Ferdy, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's, and you know, and from my end, it was like the opportunity to work on a movie like this, because to Freddie's point, there are like, so this archetype of American storytelling in cinema, but at the time it was, for a writer on spec, was a little bit kind of a hard thing, I think, to get going in terms of like, you know, something that's very character based and very sort of like tone and character based. So he mentioned The Third Man, and I was like, okay, I'm listening. And, you know, and then we just started talking about all these movies we loved and in, you know, that tone and that genre. And it just grew out of that. And all the thanks in the world to Ferdy for bringing me to this point and bringing me along to this point. So it's been kind of an amazing journey.
Let's talk about those conversations you had about tone. I mean, I think what I really loved about this movie is that it captures that tone of like 3 Days of the Condor or sure. Parallax View without feeling like a throwback. It still feels very contemporary. So tell me about the conversations that you guys had in that area and sort of nailing that down on the page.
Do you want to take it, Ferdy?
Oh, go ahead.
I think it was a lot of references, right? So we, in terms of the starting point was references, right? I actually have a notepad here that's filled with our like 18
that's
movies
cheating.
It's notes. I got notes. So we started with references, right? And like what works, what we think doesn't work, what we like, what we don't like. And then the tone, I generally, in terms of general tone, I think, you know, Ferdy can speak to this in sort of a more macro sense. I can speak to it on the page, but was a constant sort of, give and take, right? It's a constant sort of struggle to be like, all right, what's outside of the parameters we've set for ourselves? What's okay to go outside of? What's not? And what do we want to represent? And what have we decided? And, you know, for an example, like one thing to your point about it feeling contemporary, I think one thing was very important to us throughout the process was keeping it grounded, his experience grounded, you know? So he's a person, right? He's a person that needs to eat, that needs to use the bathroom, that's scared, that is, you know, like, so that was the thing we go back to, that sort of bell we kept ringing throughout. Simplistic ways, it was references. And then out of that, to make it contemporary was this character, what is this character experiencing? What does he need and want at moment to moment? So I think kept us grounded in that sense.
And then, Ferdy, as the director, once you sort of have a working script, how do you start to, again, keep that tone, keep those parameters?
Well, it's not any different. I mean, to me, the tone started before the script existed. Actually before the story existed, you know, like I said earlier, that was going to be the angle, was going to be, okay, we have this dramatic character who's in the wrong movie essentially. And that informed consequently that the tone would have to be grounded and that everything that happened to him that was kind of genre-y would be filtered by this prism of his, A, drama and the crisis that he's going through, and B, inability to deal with these situations to begin with. So that informed story-making decisions. So, and again, through various forms of inspiration and conversation. So by the time we got to having a working script, I already had, you know, tons of material that I could reference or think about to all the sort of Frankenstein pieces together that would make what is the ingredients for this specific tone that we wanted.
From
then on, it just became, okay, apply that to finding locations, apply that to finding actors. But, you know, the tone existed first.
I was going to say, I have a very full Dropbox folder, shared Dropbox folder of references, whether it be photos or books or articles or yeah.
I bet. And again, like the it feels so lived in, and I think that's really part of its appeal. And I think a big part of why it works, like you guys clearly lived with this character in this world as you were creating the story around him. I did want to ask the biggest question I had in watching it is why Greece? I'd never seen a film like this that takes place in Greece, but it felt like absolutely the right decision.
Well, I mean, definitely that feeling that you had is what we were going for. Obviously, these types of films travel around the world a lot, and that's part of the fun, you know, exploring places you don't know, also in ways that you wouldn't, even if you were to visit them. It wasn't always Greece, by the way, but then what Greece had to offer was twofold, both the political and social context that we needed for story, for, you know, to do our what goes on in the background of the story and ends up, you know, eventually more in the foreground towards the end of the film. We needed a country going through a sort of a turmoil of sorts. And this idea of activism, of regular citizens needing to engage in action, which was both useful for the story, but also to inspire our character in the way that we built him. And the other aspect to it was the more sort of visual, imagination aspect of it, which was, okay, why don't we go to Greece, but like avoid islands, you know, avoid the golden summer and the tourist ideal. Let's go in mainland Greece. And I drove around all of Greece and found these amazing places. And, you know, and after that, we actually changed the script. Depending on some locations, we morphed scenes. Backward engineered some scenes to work for some of the locations that I found, so that we could have also a variety of landscapes which would inform the amount of travel that is going on in the story.
That's smart. It makes sense. And again, it makes it feel like very panoramic, but also very claustrophobic, you know, which I think is part and parcel to these movies and works really well. In the script phase, in the storytelling phase, what were some of the challenges?
I think, you know, because to go back to references for a second, it's like you're stepping into a genre that's like, you know, sort of well trodden, you know, like, well, you know, we've gone over this a lot. So it's presenting it in a way that's not like, yeah, I've seen this, you know what I mean? I've seen this movie before, this scene before. So I think the sort of like 30's point about the originality being the character and then having to expand that to like, okay, but we, you know, we're entertaining people and we're engaging people and you're exciting them and scaring them. So it's like, how do we make sure those interesting elements that we find that we, you know, we've studied this character, we've lived with him, we've sort of studied these references. How do we make sure that's clear? Like, how do we make sure that's engaging and entertaining? And you know, we definitely had points. I remember there was one point we were working on the script together and we were kind of pacing around trying to figure something out. And it was like, have we been here too long? It was like, I think we've been here too long. And it was like, and we like removed a scene, you know, and it's like just to keep the pacing up. And it's like, I think the sort of pacing of it, make those decisions in terms of like where to turn the story and like where to, you know, to keep you moving forward. And, you know, and the other thing too, is there's just practical situations with that where you're kind of like, all right, we need to get him from A to B. How do we do that in an engaging way? How do we get him? You know, he wants to get to Athens, right? It's like, how do we get there? How do we make that engaging? How do we make that interesting? You know what I mean? So, and then all that, you said, that's the practical stuff, the puzzle that I like figuring out. And then it's like, all right, are we servicing what we're saying about the situation and the character? And do those two things, and like the nice, Freddie kind of touched on before, that nice juxtaposition of a character who sort of beckons, who sort of lets life happen to him, and put against activists who are taking charge of life, and then how that affects him and, you know, where that goes. So yeah, I think a lot of scripts, it ends up being that balance, right? Of, you know, like you've decided to touch on these themes, you decided to put them in this situation, now make all that work together. Yeah. So
trial and error.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a lot of pacing. It was a lot of pacing around, a lot of Skype calls, a lot of, you know, so a lot of rewrites.
Do you have to worry? Part of what I really like about this movie is the simplicity of the plot. It's not a convoluted plot for having a lot of ideas in it and a lot of great character stuff in it. But ultimately, like, the plot is pretty straightforward. And was that something you had to worry about, either overcomplicating it or undercomplicating it?
I'll let Freddie speak this a little bit, but I would just say that, yes, I think is a short answer. Again, it was just sort of a balance, right? It was kind of like, we've gone too far. You know, the stuff in the background, we went through multiple iterations of versions of it. I think some were too complicated, some were too simplistic. But from my end, from a storytelling standpoint, I love like a really simple setup where it's like, all right, you know, they, this guy escaped from prison, go. And that's not the setup of our movie, but just as an example, you know, like I love a really simple setup for me. So that to me is a nice challenge. It's a fun challenge. And then beyond that, it became like, yeah, not sort of going too far, but sorry, I'll let Ferdy respond to that.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because in fact, probably the opposite was more true in the development and preparation of the movie. The notes we were getting were more like, ah, this is too complicated. So I'm glad you feel the opposite way, because it took some attention. But I think the reason that feeling emerges, and I'm glad it did to you, is again our perspective is I actually think it is a little complicated eventually if you want to understand all the things that happen. But the most important thing is not necessarily that. The most important thing is experiencing them the way Beckett does, and he is clueless just the same amount that we are, you know. And we progress, and he learns little pieces as we learn them. We never disconnect from him. And I think that sort of step-by-step process, it gives you that feeling and that relatability, not just because it's piece by piece. Also, sometimes maybe the pieces are not what you think they are, but it's simply because you also see it on his face. You're like, oh, yeah, I feel the same way, man. You know, he's flabbergasted. I am too. Like, what is going on, you know?
Yeah,
so that relatability, I think, contributed to surfing the complications of the plot.
Yeah, and I think it's something, you know, we don't get that a lot in contemporary movies, right? Like it's Jimmy Stewart and The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Right. But
today we have Tom Cruise, right? It's all Mission Impossible. Right. That guy has all the answers. He can right. do anything. And it's so much fun watching this guy figure it out and feel pain and have this huge obstacle in the middle of the movie be, how am I going to get to Athens? Like, I love that becomes a huge plot point. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I think that was a target we were aiming for the whole time, was that sort of real, like truly an ordinary man, like truly, like that's, you know, like that, like presented in that way, that's, you know, it's, you know, like I said, the third man earlier, the ignorant American, is, you know, sort of obviously completely different setup, but that idea was something we kept aiming for, because it, you know, I think to Ferdy's point, the relatability of it then is further enhanced.
Yeah, absolutely. Folks, check out Beckett. It's on Netflix right now. You can watch it. Can you guys talk about what's next? Do you know what's next for each of you?
I without any specifics, I'm bouncing around between about four feature specs at different stages of development. There's like one thing it hasn't been announced yet that I don't think I'm supposed to talk about. So I'd say,
fair. But
yeah, I've been happily busy. I'll put it that way.
Great. And Ferdy, I mean, you've got two great movies now, right? You've knocked out two. You've done a bunch of shorts. What's next?
I am balancing between sanity and insanity in writing a new movie, which I'm just deep in now. And but it is another sort of exploration of genre with a very strong character at its center.
Great. Well, I can't wait to see it. Look forward to everything you guys are doing next. Thanks so much for chatting today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go around and ask you all to introduce yourselves on the microphones. Tell us some places where the listener may have seen your name or your face on their television or movie screen. And Jamie, let's start with you.
Hi, I'm Jamie Rosengard. I've written most of my TV episodes across all six seasons of Empire, but you've also seen my name on Dare Me, which aired on USA, and season 2 of Truth Be Told, which is coming out on Apple TV Plus next month.
Great. Thank you. And Michael?
My name is Michael D. Fuller. I am co-creator and executive producer of a show called Quarry that was on Cinemax a few years ago, and since then have worked on Lock and Key on Netflix and on the Mosquito Coast for Apple TV.
Terrific. Thank you. And David and Raphael, please introduce yourselves or each other, however you like to do it.
I'm David Diggs. I'm a co-creator, EP writer on Blindspotting. You might have seen me on some things. I'm an actor in the other part of my life, so I was. Most people know me from a little-known musical about a founding father, but I've been in some other shit too. You know, you just don't care about it.
Come on. People love that snowy train.
Oh, yeah. I just wrapped season 3 of Snowpiercer.
And Kimmy Schmidt. You were terrific on Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, thank you. I did that.
Kimmy Schmidt.
I'd be on the TVs. I'd be on the TVs sometimes.
Central Park. Hold on. Let me do his job for him. A number of amazing performances here.
Thank you, Raphael. And Raphael, you're the co-creator of Blindspotting and the star of the show and the movie as well.
Definitely not the star of the show. I believe my credit is and me. Co-creator, writer, showrunner. I'm in the cast. And me and David made the original movie together.
Are the power slots in the credits, so I don't know.
It's true. Let's start with Blindspotting and all of the stuff that everyone is currently working on, in as much as you can talk about it. David and Raphael, let's talk about, so Blindspotting began as this movie, which from what I understand, you guys toiled on for years and years. Both the writing and getting this made. That has been sort of well-tracked. I heard some interviews where you guys talk about that, and it's great stories. But I want to talk about the translation to television and deciding how to tell this story in a new medium, how to tell this new story in a different medium. And either of you who want to jump in on that, how did you start the conversation?
Well, I mean, the reality is that we hated the idea. It was pitched to us by Lionsgate TV, who we'd never worked with. We just knew that there was a division of Lionsgate that also did television. I don't think we were that attuned to, you know, because they're not a streamer or they're not a network. We don't really so easily track what other projects they're doing. And so they pitched this idea of Blindspotting as a show. We're like, absolutely not. Like, we're not IPing an indie movie into a thing. But of course, like, you know, our reps were pushy about it and Lionsgate was pushy about it. Like, just take the meeting. And I think that the more we looked into it, I was like, oh, well, they did Rami, and they did, you know, they've done some great other shows with artists that I know and love and like speak highly of the process. So we were on our way to the meeting to tell them no. And I remember one of us just asked the other, like, is there a world where we would say yes to this? Like, before we run in there and say no, and we sort of came up with our version. We're like, well, it'd have to be like full dance and music stuff, you know, going, there's dance and verse going on the whole time. And it's not about us. It's about the Ashley character. And we get to introduce all these new people and we can make it really bass centric. That would be the dream. Like, if they were crazy enough to let us do that, then yes, then we would do it. And we walked into the room and pitched it as sort of our way to say no without saying no. And then they said, great. So we were a little forced to take this more seriously. So we went away for a couple of weeks and came back. And I think over the course of that time, me and David really fell in love with the idea that we essentially could go back into the world of the movie without having to be responsible for just continuing the movie. And that was really exciting to us. The world building we would get to do.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I imagine you had to ask yourselves, like, when it came to the movie, what is this really about? What story were we trying to tell? Because that seems like that's the basis and the jumping off point for the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie was such a... It's also really a movie about us learning how to write a movie. And in a similar way, this TV show is the same thing. We hadn't done that before either. And so... But we watch a lot of TV, and I think there were just things there were things we knew that we wanted to see, you know, so it was about how do we make an effective container for these things and then just ask for help as much as possible to figure out how to actually make those exist in a format that we had never worked in before. But it, but yeah, I think getting to center the story on Jasmine's character was such a luxury. Once you get over the ego death that like the network has no, like had zero qualms about us not being in it. We're like, it didn't faze them at all. but I think getting to center it on Ashley and getting to write, we do this anyway when we write, we're always writing for people that we know. And then you adapt it when the actor gets in there. But to have the actor also be the person that we know so well and to get to write for her particular desires and stuff is like a really good jumping off place, I think, because it helps focus the ideas on like, oh, we know our friend would really like to do this on a TV show. So let's make sure we write that in. There was sort of a more condensed palette than I think we started the film with, which was nice.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And we had a bunch of experience about like, there was already a world we had built that was this kind of memory play of Oakland that existed in our film. And like, so it's just about revisiting that world, which it turns out that like a half hour show is pretty good at, you know, building a world and revisiting it often.
And it has, I feel like given that half hour, you have the luxury of not having to be so plot heavy as it might have been for a longer format. You can sort of live with these characters, which is feels like what the movie did so well too, and is clearly what you guys are drawn to, is these characters and their lives and the way they interact. I want to pick up on the learning curve in a minute, but Jamie, you are nodding all through this. I want to talk about you've developed a number of shows, you're out pitching a show. Let's talk about how you find your way into the story you want to tell.
I think that's still new to me. I came up, you know, a much more traditional path in TV. I started as a showrunner's assistant for Eileen Chaykin on this very small ABC medical drama called Black Box. And it was a show that didn't have a traditional TV studio. The creator had never worked in television before. And so it was really an all hands on deck situation where Eileen really brought me into the room with her every day, flew me to set in New York, let me sit with her in editing while she was there, which is how she learned editing, doing the same thing with Aaron Spelling. So felt like I was getting a pretty premium education. And as that show was coming to an end, she got the job running Empire, which at that point was just finishing up the pilot. It hadn't even been officially picked up by Fox yet. And so I went over with her as she started working on Empire. And so I ended up moving up the ranks that way. I started as showrunner's assistant, left the show as a producer, having written, I think, 12 episodes, and then, you know, have been on staff on Dare Me and then Truth Be Told. And now I'm a co-executive producer on the show with the fancy little mug, which is what happens when Reese Witherspoon turbocharges your project. You get tchotchkes. So for me, staffing has always been very comfortable, and I'm kind of addicted to just knowing something is going to get made and that routine and that kind of instant gratification of that process and procedure and knowing what to expect. So it's only over the last 2 years that I've really branched out more into development. And I had a week before the pandemic started, I sold my first pilot to Freeform, and I'm now hopefully working on something new. But that's been the scariest part to me, to go from, I think, having some semblance of a structure and other people's voices to doing that on my own, and kind of finding, you know, learning how to not be quite so accommodating and learning how to, what are the boundaries of reasserting yourself and knowing when it's okay to say no to things, I think has been more of my struggle in a way.
Well, let's dig in on that for a sec, because I think that's valuable stuff. How have you learned? How have you figured out? Come on.
No,
what has the process been like?
It's different. I mean, I think it was 6 years that I spent on staff and I loved every single second of it. And I don't think there's anything better than just making things and kind of learning the trial and error that way. But it is different when you have to just make everything in your own voice and really live in the ramifications of saying yes or saying no to something. And so I think a few ways that I've just grappled with it is learning, you know, when to say you don't know or when you need to think about something and not feeling like you have to give an instant response or responding out of anger or need to be conciliatory in the moment. And just really knowing which things are the most important to your show and what really is the premise or the heart of the thing that makes you most excited that you cannot move away from.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Is that finding that heart of your show, does that come easily for you?
I think that what's been most surprising to me is acknowledging that part of the beauty of TV is that it's living and breathing, and therefore that premise may evolve in ways that surprise even you. The first show that I sold was about, it was kind of about alternative musicians in East Nashville who define themselves very much against kind of our mainstream conception of Nashville and country music. And I had a very clear idea of exactly what I wanted it to be about, these two best friends, one of whom fit our understanding of classic country music and another who had a much more authentic connection to it, but wasn't deemed that by the establishment. And, you know, it was so interesting. Like, I had a really clear inciting incident. And then the weekend after we sold the show, there was a massive tornado that struck East Nashville and kind of upended just East Nashville, not any of downtown classic Nashville, and really kind of reestablished the power dynamics there and who was affected. And like, Trump didn't even come to speak to them, knowing that it was kind of this liberal bubble within a red state. And then compounded by what happened with COVID and how that affected live musicians and the ability to perform. And I just had to kind of just acknowledge that, sure, I had my idea of how this was going to start and my characters could stay the same and their relationship to each other could stay the same. But it also would have been false not to acknowledge how the world had changed in, you know, even these couple of short weeks before, since we had sold it to when we were actually writing and would be making it.
Yeah, that's great. And the show, did the show not go?
Oh, I mean, this is a whole other story. Crazy things. The show, which was pitched to me as a sure thing because it was the passion project of the president of the network, and often then that president of the network is no longer there. So just a reminder that sure things do not exist. You have to just love them.
Yep. Every time, right? Every time. Michael, let's pick up on a similar topic of sort of finding the show's voice. You know, you're in development now on some projects. You've run a show with Corey, or you co-run a show. Let's talk about, you know, any of those and learning about what's important to the show versus sort of letting go of that ego or finding the, you know, finding what works in the development process.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the trickiest propositions in doing any of this. And I think, you know, with Quarry, my writing partner at the time and I had found the books. We had kind of been working on an original idea that was in the same space, kind of a Southern period noir. And we said, hey, let's get our chocolate in this peanut butter. And we kind of had the notion of what the, you know, what the, as you're saying, the heart of the show was. Like, we pitched it as non-Confederate flag, gritty Dukes of Hazzard. You know, like, it's like, it's going to be like, what, like the dark underbelly of the Dukes of Hazzard, and not just Boss Hogg running around being, you know, latently racist and all those things, but just the fun of, like, you know, the fun of that, but then kind of the darkness of it. So whatever we did, we kind of had that fixed prism of, all right, this is what we put the characters through. This is what we put the story through. And it helps having a series of books that we, you know, kind of adapted pretty liberally, but at the heart of it, it was about, that show was about a soldier coming home to with PTSD and not really being welcome. So we kind of knew what the emotional dynamics were. And so we held on to that. And I think, as with anything, and And these guys all know on both ends of the camera and all the process, there's what you, when you're brainstorming and spitballing and, you know, blue skying something, okay, that's great. That's one version of the story. Then it's going to go through a process of you actually reading it and saying, what the hell was half of this? Or, oh, wow, who came up? I think I came up with, especially with a writing partner, I think I came up with, no, okay, it was you, but it's still great. But you know, just that kind of thing where it's, you make new discoveries throughout every step of the process. And then that's just in the writing. And so I think it's like, all right, we always know. And I try to always know, like, this was the thing that sparked me to it initially. If I can hold on to what that is, then it's only going to get better by opening it up, especially in TV, because it is so, you know, film is obviously collaborative as well, but TV much more so. That it's like, okay, what's this person gonna, you know, we had a director come on. He had his thoughts and his touchstones and his references that were things we had never even seen or heard of. That brings a whole new element to it. And so, you know, that kind of, that kernel of the spark of what initially drew me or to a project or to a story, try to hold on to as much as I can, but allowing for that to grow with the process, I think has been the thing that, and it wasn't easy for me to learn that, to your point and to what Jamie was saying, especially on Quarry, because so much of it, I mean, that was my first thing that I had created that was being made. It wasn't something I was staffed on. And there were things where I was, you know, I look back and I'm like, this is the hill that I was going to die on, the hill of like, the sofa in the protagonist's house, because it was like, this sofa is crazy and it looks, the pattern's terrible and whatever. And then having my our director, who was great and understood exactly where we were coming from, was like, come look at the monitor, look at how it reads on camera, it's just a sofa. And it's like, it's just a sofa. That's what I always, anytime I get hung up on, like, is this, it's like, nope, just, is this just a sofa or is this a thing? And it's, you know, most of the time,
especially during COVID, like, yeah, you had to kind of let a lot of that go. I spent like 2 hours on set being, we were shooting at a Shiva, which is, you know, Jewish, you know, remembrance. And it just looked so wrong because it was outside because of COVID and we couldn't have the right amount of people there. And I was just like, we're all going to just accept this. I need to just let it go. This is my sofa.
Yeah. Well, and it was exactly, this is my sofa. It was realizing too, it's like, man, I want to take the work seriously, but also it's like, people didn't like the work with Stanley Kubrick a lot. Not that I was, but it's like that attention to like the sofa. That's the way that he operated. And it's like, it's just this. It's okay. The people watching it aren't going to say, I really, that scene was so close, but that sofa was just really fucking me up the whole time, you know? So yeah, it's just kind of like that, and keeping a hold of like, okay, this is where we're all coming from and this is what, and then, but also allowing for what that is to become something new and exciting, you know?
We had to fight really hard for an actual sofa as well. Oh, and yeah, yeah. Maybe the battle wasn't worth it in hindsight, but it's a really good, yeah, it's a really good couch.
I'm sitting there laughing, just going like, I'd have died on that hill.
almost did. It almost happened.
Bury me with this sofa. For letting, yeah, go. My brain can't let go.
Yeah.
So has this, I mean, Raphael, you're running Blindspotting, right? Like, so have you learned these lessons? Are you still dying for a sofa? Like, how's the learning curve been for you?
Well, first of all, like, nobody really knows what the fuck a showrunner does. So, and I've done it now for one season and I still don't know. So I feel like we're all trying to sort of figure out how our show works and how best to do that. I wouldn't say that I'm the one running the show. I would say that I'm the one most consistently running the show. I think like Diggs and Jess and Keith were all, you know, the executive producers of the show. And even though Diggs and I are credited as like the co-creators, like there really is four of us. I mean, Jess and Keith are just as like, if Keith says he doesn't like something, it means the same as if Diggs said he didn't like something. Like, we have to consider it and talk about it. But they're also there's some other projects that they're doing and they're not required to be there in the same capacity, the amount of time that I'm there. And so in a lot of ways, like my job is mostly to be the constant. And like, if Diggs has an opinion on something, make sure that he's aware of this other thing that maybe he wasn't in this meeting for, so it can inform his opinion the best. But also like every showrunner that I talked to leading up to the show couldn't give me a straight answer on what the job was. Or the way that they went about it was totally different, and we have no union and we're not really paid directly as show owners. Like, it's not a real job. It's sort of like it's a focal point for blame and and for final say, for like, well, who's going to pull the trigger today and move this thing forward? And so on our show, it's like, well, Keith gave his opinion and Jess gave her opinion and Diggs gave his opinion. All right, well, we have to choose right now. So I'm going to say it's this, you know, and be responsible for whether or not that was the right or the wrong choice. That's really the gig. But also, we did our show during COVID, which is the first show that we've ever run. Diggs and I have acted on other shows, not during COVID. But running a show during COVID is just unprecedented. There's no, if a kid sneezes on our set, we have to blow air through the set for an hour and like clear everyone out. And that's in the middle of a scene of that. We're like, we had that happen in the middle of a scene. We were rewriting in the moment because characters start performing things differently than they were written. And that's a good thing. But like, if Candace delivers a line with a different intention than it is intended, or Jalen makes a joke that is a different kind of joke than was intended on the page, we're in there. There's pictures of us in there, like flipping the page and being like, move this up to here. And then you say this. And then why don't you make, what was that joke you said yesterday? Let's do that again. Let's do that here. And then that'll kick to her, you know? So I think the thrill for us as writers is like, we come from rap music. We come from theater. We come from studio sessions. So much of it is about like reactionary art and improvisational art. And so when we start jamming in the room with the cast and we start coming up with ideas, I think that's when Diggs and I feel particularly alive, is the work is coming to life in the moment with the actors. And we're actually in concert with each other. I think those are the moments that like Diggs and I feel the most maestro about our shit. It's like, oh man, the cinematography is gelling with the director, is gelling with the script, is gelling with the actors. And now we're getting into something. And that was really hard to achieve during COVID, because we're like mask, shield, stand 6 feet apart, you know? So the only time you get to really jam is when the cameras are rolling. And so I think we were just trying to keep the cameras rolling as much as possible so we could do our jobs.
Tell me about your writing staff and how you worked with them.
Well, we went about our staff. So we were given a writer's room green light in January of, not this past January, but the one prior. And we were told like they were ready to make the show soon. We need to get these scripts done. And we had like a week to launch into the writer's room. And I think they assumed that David and I would write everything. But we have, of our six protagonists, we have four of them are women. We have no business writing this art by ourselves. No business. But we are switching our IP, so we're obviously going to be heavily involved. And so David was in Canada shooting Snowpiercer. So he wasn't going to be able to be really around for the writer's room. So we were going to get back to one of our rituals, which is if one of us can't be there, we're like up in the middle of the night telling them what we changed during the day and shooting holes in an idea or whatever. But they were sending us all these writing samples from writers that we didn't know. We were like, well, how in God's name, we don't know how to do this. How in God's name in 4 weeks are we going to crack a season with people that we don't know? And writing samples are so misleading. I can write a great writing sample. Doesn't mean I'm going to be the right person for someone to work with. And so we went with people that we knew. We hired Alana Brown, who I just seen her first indie film. I met her at a friend's house in the Bay. She's a great writer and a great director. And I thought she was going to be fascinating to work with. She'd done this movie about the Rwandan genocide and four women living under a kitchen for 90 days, like trapped under there together. I was like, you're a fascinating writer. Nigel Lumumin, who had just done a movie called Jin, which she wrote and directed. That's about the Bay, even though she shot it in LA, it's about growing up Muslim in the Bay. And then Priscilla Garcia-Jaquer, who had been a showrunner's assistant. And I'd known her because of a web series she did about Latino identity. And we had been in sort of in concert conversation about the complexities of that for years. And so me and Diggs were just like, let's just hire them. And we'll hire Ben Turner, who's eventually going to play Earl, who's an amazing writer. And we went up to Canada for a week and we like sat in a big sort of hotel suite and talked it through. And David would come through at like 10 or 11 at night when he got off set and we'd talk it out. And then we'd go back in all day and do it again. And we did that. We went back to LA and did it for another 3 weeks. And we kind of came up with this Bible of the show we thought we were definitely going to make just like it was written in the Bible. And then two great, awful, terrible things happened. COVID hit and everything stopped. And we got our budget, which is like not possible to make the thing that we had made a Bible for on that budget.
We also got people to explain to us what the budget meant, which turns out like things are way more expensive than you imagine they are.
So we had no sense of like really that process at all. We went into the winter of the pandemic and all we could think to do was like, oh my God, everyone's out of the job. All of our writers are out of the job. Let's beg the network for additional scripts. I'm doing air quotes for everyone listening. But additional scripts are just like hire all of our writers to go off and write their first pass at a script, basically while we wait to see what happens with the pandemic. And we did that for the next 6 months. All of our writers got, you know, whatever the standard fee is for additional scripts. They went off, they wrote two drafts, and we just killed time, you know, polishing these scripts and adding characters and totally changing the Bible and consolidating the story to make it fit into a significantly smaller budget than I think we understood we were getting, you know, and then finally we randomly got the green light in the fall and it was like, yeah, the green light. So your 10 week starts like tomorrow, start your pre-production. And we only had maybe half the scripts. Maybe we had five, in really, really early stages. And so then it was like a mad dash to get it done, but we only had 4 weeks of actual writer's room. And the rest was like people off writing by themselves. We didn't do 16 or 8 or any of that. So again, we don't know what we're doing.
It's nice to hear the rest of you guys talk about the sort of adaptability of it all, because like that did to me define so much of how the show came out, and I love so much of how the show came out. So I'm glad that that's not like a fluke, you know.
Well, and you guys having that improvisational, you know, background and ability to be nimble in the moment like that is just. It's good on any level, but you know, I think especially with TV, especially dealing with, as you're saying, making a show during a damn once in a century pandemic, especially, you know, like, all right, you got to pivot quickly, both on the page and in the production itself.
I mean, it must have disrupted everyone's writing process, right? Like we're, you know, just thank God we didn't have to do our writer's room on Zoom, but I think that's probably in our near future. You know, I can't even imagine what it's like to have a dynamic with people on that. Did you do that?
I'm in my second Zoom room.
What is that like? What is this world?
So I was in one all last year. It was Lock and Key season 3. And fortunately, that was a third season. So we all knew each other. You know, we had been in a room for, at that point, 3 years together. And so we knew each other's, you know, tics and like patterns and just kind of like what, who's good at what, whatever else. I cannot even fathom, and Jamie can probably speak to this, I haven't had to do it yet, into a new room with new people where you don't have that shorthand, because that is over Zoom is just, that is, feels like death to me. No pun intended.
Yeah, I started the first week of April in 2020 on Truth Be Told season 2. And there was, aside from the show's creator and one writer, I believe, everyone on the staff was new. And the show is kind of, it's Octavia Spencer is the lead, and she plays kind of like a serial type podcaster, but the case is completely brand new each season. So you're really starting from scratch, not just with a room, but it's a whole new world and case, brand new sets, brand new mystery, brand new everything. So we're all trying to get to know each other over Zoom, which we've all just started using like a week earlier, come up, and it's a heavily serialized show. So I think that more than anything requires like meticulous boards and long arc tracking and all of those things that you would normally have in a physical space. So it was just really challenging, even just figuring out the mechanics of who speaks when and how are we going to actually lead the room? What type of software are we going to use to track everything? All of those nitty gritty details that you really take for granted. It was just starting completely fresh. And then I started in March on the show, The Last Thing He Told Me, and that's brand new as well, all new writers. But fortunately, we have such an incredible book that it's based on, with the same title. And the author of the book is also the creator and co-showrunner of the series. So that was very helpful that we had a Bible to constantly refer back to. But yeah, it's just there's no way to just like naturally and spontaneously kind of build on things in the way that you would in person.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's really hard.
It's also strange just not meeting people that you spend so much time with. Like, I think I've still only met half of the Truth Be Told writers because I was one of only two people on set. And I'm just like, what if someone's tall? And I think they're short. Like, it's a whole different energy. I don't know what kind of shoes they wear.
It's a context thing.
Yeah.
It's a you're trying to transfer sort of the emotional sensitivities and capacities of right. Like everything you just outlined is also like largely like the logistical challenges alone, like just the logistics. And when we get into like, I'm trying to communicate, like Alana just told us a story about her going from being hyper religious to like questioning her fundamental beliefs as an influence on this character's transition in episode 4 or 5. How are we like taking the emotional weight of that through a screen and getting it on the board and holding it? Because when someone tells you that story in person, it like rocks your body. You know, you can feel the sensitivity of the subject matter. And on here, like I could look at something on my desk and just like tune out for a second in such a different way and miss the emotional weight of the thing. I think that's what I get freaked out about, is like, the in-person thing is how you recognize the unspoken parts of those sharing moments as the actual humanity. Like someone tells a sensitive story and I want to write their body language into the character when they tell it, and I can't see it. You know, I can't feel it in the same way.
And not just their body language, but the way it reverberates around everyone else. I think you can just read how well a pitch is landing based on how everyone else reacts to it, or how they get uncomfortable, or just trying to read into what's making that work. And you just can't do it the same way on Zoom, especially when everyone's making their like, I swear I'm listening faces.
We're doing like a nostalgia prompt in a way that I think we've never had to do in television before. We're like, having to think back almost exclusively on the way that we connect with certain experiences because we can't do it in real time in the room and then transfer it to the story. Like everything we're doing is memory. We had to do this with the Bay because we couldn't shoot mostly in the Bay because they wouldn't give us permits. So like our show has to be an exercise in a certain level of nostalgia because we couldn't be on the ground and react to this space, except for, I think we had 2 weeks total to actually be in the place where the show is set. You know, which is why so many of the writers are from there, but even they are sourcing from memory because we couldn't do it there.
I didn't realize you guys didn't get to shoot there for any significant amount of time. You have to worry about capturing the feel of a place that's so important to the story.
If there was one sofa we were going to die on, it was that. And we just kept pushing for more and more Bay time. But like, we actually had another like terrible, great, wonderful thing happen to us so the houses, there was like no, everyone thought there was no way we could shoot all of the exteriors in the Bay. So we were going to find these houses in LA. We like did this massive search to find like a block that could feel like it was in West Oakland.
It's Victorian architecture, to be clear. Like it's a particular kind of architecture that we needed.
But also that, and we're, you know, we grew up there. So there's so many things like the height of there's so many dead giveaways, right? The height of the telephone wires, how much disrepair the street is in, how wide the street is in, whether it's a double yellow line or not, like all of these things. And we found two houses next to each other that were kind of close. And we had sort of been working with our art department. We were going to build, you know, houses that replicated this on art set and then do, you know, and then we're getting like pretty close to production. We've already started building these houses and one of the owner of the main house got sick and was like unsure as to whether it was COVID or not, but was also totally uncomfortable with having people in their house, and we lost the houses. And we were like, oh, well, since we lost them anyway, maybe we should just go look for houses up in the Bay then and sort of retool our whole design.
It was like that night I was on Google Maps going through the streets of West Oakland trying to find two houses that looked like the houses
similar to the ones we had already started building.
Millions on building. And found these ones. And I think before they could say no, our whole leadership team was on a bus on the way to the Bay to scout them. Because we all saw this as like a big opportunity. And then just basically shot the whole series in, like, you know, 80% of the series in LA with these big holes in it, just with our fingers crossed that at the end we would get 2 weeks in the Bay, which, by the way, the network had only agreed to 2 days at this point.
Yeah. We were sort of gambling that we were going to be able to convince them to give us more. We're like stealing money from other places, being like, hey, if we cut down on this, like, doesn't that equal a day? Like, shouldn't we didn't use all of this budget. Like, that feels like a day.
We would write it into the script as like something that you couldn't get out of. and then they cross into the 14th and Peralta intersection where there's a particular light they step under. You know, it's like, would cost so much more to recreate. So that we would get more and more days, and it paid off. Like, you know, it feels like a base show. Most people don't know that we, you know, and really 2 weeks sounds like a very small amount, but if you're shooting, I mean, you guys know as people who've made TV before, if you get 5 or 6 days per episode and one of those days is on location, you can add a lot of texture. You can get, you know, 3 exterior moments and a drone shot and a whatever and pepper it through an episode. And it really does feel like everything outdoors is living in this place.
We ran into a similar thing on Quarry, which was set in Memphis, and it was very, very, it was like super important for us. I'm from the South and grew up going to Memphis. Like, this is a Memphis show, and we shot the pilot in and around Memphis, and then the networks said HBO Cinemax said, that's great, we're gonna pick it up, but you got to shoot it in New Orleans. And we're like, okay, well, how do we do that? New Orleans is a very completely different place than Memphis. Do we move it to, we'll just, you know, I guess we could suck it up and move it to New Orleans, but that was a sofa to die on. And said, so no, and they actually said, no, we love the Memphis of it all. We're going to give you 2 weeks in Memphis, but it's like, then everything you're shooting in New Orleans is like fleur-de-lis are everywhere and like Mardi Gras stuff. And so you had to shoot all around. We were there during Mardi Gras, so had to shoot around so much of what that was. But to your point, Raphael, we had 2 weeks there and it's a period show. It's set in the 70s. So it was like, you know, we had 2 weeks, but we knew exactly what, and Google Street being our friend, we knew like, all right, this is exactly the Memphis landmark we're getting. This is exactly the neighborhood we're going to go do these exteriors. And I'll talk to people now who are from Memphis and they're surprised that we shot it in New Orleans. And it's because we did. We wove those, those Memphis landmarks. So it, and we really took, you know, as you guys being from there and it being in your DNA, we tried to make every aspect of the show feel as though it had that in it. So no matter what, we could have shot it out here and it wouldn't have mattered, you know, as long as we got
it. It like amplifies every other touch point, you know, like then we just went crazy on the music and on the lingo and on the, you know, and on the super niche references that don't, like the episode that just aired, our episode 6 just aired, and we put this Shane Company engagement ring commercial that played on the radio all throughout our childhood. Like, and we played it almost in full on the episode on the radio because people from there are going to be like, oh my God, you know, and it was all Twitter was doing the night it aired was just they put the Shane
Company. Twitter was like, Shane Company. It was a stunt.
You know,
sure.
It's just something that anyone from the Bay can like cite the whole commercial because their entire marketing campaign is just radio spots. So they played like 30 times a day.
It's really heartening to hear that from all of you that like you can get away with this. You can still give that great lived-in feeling with, you know, the short amount of time to shoot in the actual place and bolster these other things. I want to pick up on something we were talking about a minute ago, which is being in person. I met with an executive recently who was saying, I love Zoom. It's so great. Maybe we don't have to have pitches in the room anymore. Maybe we can do this all virtually. And yes, I would love to not drive to Santa Monica, But let's talk about that. What is gained? What is lost? Anyone who wants to jump in?
With pitching specifically?
Yeah, Jamie, you've been out there most recently.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm just about to start doing it. And I would say that I'm getting hammered in a lovely way because I adore my producers. They're just really so worried about time and how short things need to be in order to maintain interest over Zoom. And I think almost to the detriment of what you're pitching and just hoping that, you know, you can just get everything you've lost back out in the Q&A. But I think when you are in person, it's a little bit less rigid and you can just read, you can see what's landing in the moment and react a bit more and know where you should pull back or where you can really lean into it and expand a bit more. So sure, for generals or even project specific meetings, I think you can make it work over Zoom and save your gas. But I think for pitches, it does seem like there is a lot lost, especially if you have if you're lucky enough to be in a position where multiple people want it. I think you really want to know who was most excited in the room and who really viscerally had a strong response and which parts of the story they got the most and if they really intuitively understood it or if they were just excited by a premise or something like that.
Yeah, that's the time thing that Jamie speaks to. I pitched something a couple of months ago that they're in the process of working out a deal for, which is great, but there's two things happening right now, which is at this moment in time, the market is because the whole ecosystem is extremely backlogged. So there's that. And then there is the Zoom of it all. And there are upshots of it in that, like when I'm pitching, I can be a little bit more scripted, than I necessarily would be, but, and you kind of have to be because it's not as much of a conversation. It's much more of a show me, dance for me, you know? And because I'm only going to be looking at this and you do have that window of compressed time. And you can do cool visual slideshows, but to Jamie's point, and it goes back to what Raphael was saying with, you know, and being in the room and whatever else in terms of the writer's room, there's just so much in terms of that energy that comes where you can tell if somebody's leaning in on something or if they're not, then you can reel them back in. Whereas with this, there's just, you are quite literally boxed in. And so that's the biggest challenge where I think, yeah, generals, amen. Let's zoom it up for as long as we can. But I think pitches, I like being there in person because you then actually are having a conversation as opposed to, you know, here's my PowerPoint presentation, open the floor to any questions, you know, and that can be great. There's people who can do it great and you can succeed with that, but there's a ticking clock on that, man, because people will, and it's just human nature, will just gloss over and it becomes, you know, they start thinking about like, lunch is coming up. Did I refill the car? Oh, I'm not going anywhere because it's COVID. You know, it's just people just check out.
Yeah, we've tried to be more strategic about even, I hate talking, so I like to do this anyway, but the current show I'm working on is based on a real woman. And so we kind of trade off a bit. So I feel like whenever you're getting into a lull of potentially glazing over, I'm like, here's a new voice to listen to that will jolt you back out of it. Or let the, you know, we have an actress attached to him. Like, please speak as much as you want. Like whatever you want to ad lib, just like make people engage. Yeah. I feel like you're almost just coaxing people to really stick with you for the entire pitch in a way that you don't normally have to.
It's an interesting point that you're making about like, it also just depends on what kind of person you are, you know, because like David and I are performers. We'll go into a room and just like finger gun it out. Like, you know, and like, you know, cause we love to perform something that we're excited about. And so we can ramble, we will ramble an hour easy. Like, I mean, take this podcast, for example, we'll just talk. But I do think we would have these conversations before the pandemic about like, oh, do you send the script ahead of time? Do you send the deck ahead of time? Do you do the pitch and then do you send it? And now more than ever, I am so certain. And I was this way before. I send everything ahead of time. I just don't even want to talk if you haven't read the shit. Because if you don't like it, we just won't do the meeting. And then none of us has to sit through anything shitty. And if you've read a treatment and or a treatment and a Bible and a script and you still want to meet, we don't have to talk about any of the shit that was in there. Like that's assumed that you've all, I can kind of re-present it, you know, but I don't have to like spend 40 minutes covering it again. And instead I can just talk about why this is a really great idea that we should do right now. I think at least, you know, obviously me and David have taken out a bunch of other stuff since then, but like when we took out blind spotting, the thing that was really exciting about it was like, we got to play a video of Ben Turner doing like a poem at this event in Miami, and they'd all get excited about that. And then we'd like, you know, pull up pictures of Helen Hunt as Rainey, which we didn't have her on board yet, but we were like, nah, but like we kick it with Helen. I think she might do it. You know, like sort of just be more emphatic about the show. Because I, for me, at least I'm starting to realize that like, if they're on board with the idea, the meeting is just like, not do you love the idea, but do we think you motherfuckers can pull it off? You know, I feel like it's, we're in there really just being like, do you believe that we can champion the idea to completion? And I think now when I think about whether or not we want to be a part of anyone else's project, like what I look for in terms of my buy-in is, do I think you're going to run the ball? Or do I think you're going to leave this ball in my arms and I'm going to have to run it and I didn't sign up for that shit? You know, so like if, in terms of a show creator, like that would, if I'm trying to imagine if I was an exec, I'm like, do you have the juice to get it to the finish line? Are you that in love with it? Or is this just like another project for a paycheck? Because in the world of TV and content now, the shit that wins are the ones that have people at the head of them that really like, this is their life's work that they're working on right now.
I'm as a, like I've become an EP on a number of projects now that I'm not writing, and they're all in, like we're pitching one this evening, but it feels like there's a lot more usefulness for the sort of EP people who are going to speak less in the pitch. It's, you are benefited if we do a lot more pre-selling the thing. We're like garnering, making sure the excitement in the fake room is more palpable, you know, doing all, if I know anybody who's on the team who's going to be listening to this, I need to make sure I call them and be like, hey, just so you know, this is the only thing I care about. Like, it's my favorite shit. It's about, the, oh my God, it's so exciting. Your kids are going to love it, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you know, like a whole bunch of like wheel greasing that maybe was sort of less necessary. I mean, still necessary, but like in the, if you can, if you're in a situation where you're in person and you can feel palpably the excitement, then it's different. But like, you sort of need it for a Zoom pitch to be really successful, the ones I've been in that have been successful, it's like when everybody is performing their excitement, right? Like when the audience has to perform their excitement too, because they want you to know that they're actually excited about it. Like those are the kind of the only times it goes well. And if anybody is like, doesn't feel like they have to be on, then it just feels dead.
Yeah. And I think you've just made the best case for partnering with a production company is like those people should be there to hype the crowd, right? They should do all that pre-pitch work. Jamie, you're gonna add something?
No, I was just, it's so interesting. I feel like, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, I feel like there was even more emphasis than usual on some type of, not just a PowerPoint, but some type of like, and this doesn't have a pejorative association to me, but like a gimmick of some kind. So we, for example, when we were attaching an actress in a bigger production company, it's about the first female and youngest ever auctioneer at Christie's. So we opened our pitch with a fake auction because her whole thing is that she can sell anything to anyone. And she used to, as an icebreaker at like kind of stiff or awkward events, she would sell a free drink at like an open bar event, which she like has sold for like $5,000 just to get like wasps to loosen up. So we opened it with that. And I just feel like it kind of got everyone over Zoom to relax a little bit. But now I feel like the time has become the premium and there's a little bit less leeway. So it's an interesting thing to keep navigating, which is like, do you want to cut the pitch down and maybe take some essential details out, but give them more of the flavor with an actual experience? Or what is the most important way to go? And I think we're all still, or I am, figuring it out.
It feels like
I think we all are.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you're totally right. It feels like early pandemic, we were so excited about anything interesting that could be done on Zoom, right? I was watching like Zoom theater pieces and I was like, you know, this isn't so bad. It's pretty cool. And like at this point, I'm just like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. And I don't care how cool the thing you're doing is. Like, I just would like to not be doing this anymore. So like, please, please, no fireworks, no anything. I don't need your AR, like, your fucking, you know, like, I don't care. I don't want you to appear as a hologram in my house. Like,
yeah. Tone it down. down, just like get like what's the but I feel like if we can, if you can like sell people on the excitement of like, look, if we just get through this part, we'll be on set soon and we'll make it, you know. I do think sometimes the meetings get so stale, people forget that they make fucking TV for a living. Like they forget that like their job is fun and cool as shit. And they're like, you know, like we're in here like, and all right, so in the first, you know, in the first five pages you have blah, 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 blah. And the, you know, so our A storyline is this, you're like, yo, I understand that like this requires mechanics in order to get it to the finish line. But like, we watch TV without any of that. You know, if my best, my best experiences of watching something are the moments when I'm completely unaware of structure and I'm just on the ride with some artist's great story or some group of artists' great story. And then sometimes it feels like in those meetings, you need to like at least enough of a reset to be like, let's remember what we do. We make TV to entertain people. That's the job.
Yeah, we're not all in like forensic accounting, which I'm sure is an exciting profession, but it's like, yeah, like, hey, you get to hear story, people tell you stories they're excited about for a living and decide if they get to make them. So let's, yeah, for sure.
No shade to forensic accountants.
No, forensic accountants.
Don't add us on that. That's a skill. Hey, come on.
Yeah. That was, now that the was four of us will come for me. Yeah.
Now the four of us will write a show about forensic accounting.
Exactly. And it'll be, and it'll be like,
that's our contribution to the field.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad you brought it up. Most of the audience for this show is forensic accountants. Yeah. let's wrap up as we always do. I mean, Rafael, you set us up perfectly for talking about stuff that moves us, stuff that we love to watch, stuff that gets us excited or inspired. What are you watching on television lately? What is getting you going and sort of fueling you? And Jamie, let's start with you on this one.
I am completely obsessed with Physical on Apple, and I listened to your podcast with Annie, who couldn't seem more delightfully different than that kind of acidic, toxic lead character. But it's just, I really haven't seen anything like it before, where you're contrasting the beauty of this location and Rose Byrne's like perfect face with someone who just is filled with such self-lacerating hatred at every turn. It's really just feels so bold and exciting to watch. So that is my favorite right now.
Yeah, good one. Michael.
I am thoroughly enjoying Sweet Tooth on Netflix. I think it's a terrific comic if anybody is interested in that. And Jeff Lemire is just a brilliant creator. But the show actually did a trick where the comic's pretty dark and grim and took a story about a pandemic and about the, you know, a virus sweeping the world and turn it into this amazing, like early Amblin Spielbergian adventure story where you never feel it doesn't pull punches, but you don't feel that, you know, weight of what we've lived through. It feels like a really cool way. And it's just incredibly cast and just so inventive. And it's a fun watch that, it's entertaining and engaging on all the levels for me.
Yeah. Agree. It's an incredibly sweet show, which we don't get a ton of, or haven't seen a ton of in the past few years. And it's nice to see.
I feel like there's kind of a shift starting to happening in general, where I feel like people are wanting kind of we don't want the grim dark apocalypse. We want the Sweet Tooth apocalypse. We want, you know, Ted Lasso instead of what, you know, like whatever the inverted, the dark version of that would be. And, you know, I think it's we don't want the wrestler. We want Ted Lasso, you know? And I think that's, the wrestler is fantastic and I love it, but it's, you know, it's just, I think that's kind of, and it's nice to see that with the show. I think they pulled that off really well.
Absolutely. Yeah. David, what are you watching?
This is so like square, but honestly, the only thing I've been watching is Vera. I'm a big detective show fan and I hadn't ever watched that one. So I'm on season 10 now, but I've caught up with the entirety of Vera. I'm obsessed with it. It's all I can seem to watch at the end of the day these days.
Has this been a pandemic watching digging into 10 seasons of this?
I wish I could say it had been, but no, this is sort of post-pandemic. This is definitely like while I've been at work, like shooting Snowpiercer, sure. Like on breaks going and watching Vera. Like but this is what I do. I'm like a big, like most of what I watch are BBC detective series. That's like my favorite stuff out. And so in this one, I was shocked to find one that had been on for so long that I hadn't seen yet. And it really clicks all the buttons for me. Like way too many murders in a really small area. Incredible acting, even when the situations are silly. I love these shows. I really do. Poirot is my favorite show of all time. So it's in that. It checks a lot of boxes.
Have you watched Rosemary and Thyme?
Absolutely. That was a pandemic watch for me. Rosemary and Thyme is, I mean, like, it blew my mind. The first episode of that blew my mind, and I could not stop until I finished the whole thing. Yeah. A landscaper and a botanist team up to solve murders every week is so out there. That is so wild.
It shouldn't work.
It's one of those things. It shouldn't work, but it does. And that's Rafa says this all the time. That is the most powerful phrase in art. It shouldn't, but it does.
Yeah. My favorite phrase is, it's actually really good. I think when somebody says, feel like there's so much implied by it's actually really good. It's like you doubted it and it surpassed your expectation. It wasn't overhyped. You were ready to hate on it and you couldn't. It's so powerful.
Yeah. What has been that for you, Raphael, in this past year or so?
What have I been watching? I have like my two lanes. Like I'm going back and watching like prestige shows that I never got around to. Like I'm just now watching 6 Feet Under, which is blowing people's minds who like loved 6 Feet Under, but I had never seen it. And there's all this magical realism shit in it. And I'm like, oh man, this shit's way ahead of its time. Like we be doing this magical realism shit on our show, but they did this so long ago. You know, it's another great reminder that there are no new ideas, just like new ways the new ideas are presented, which I love, especially when like, I don't know if you guys have these moments in interviews, but like the interviewer would be like, we've never seen that your show does this and we've never seen it before. It's so nice to be able to be like, no, that's not true. We have to stop doing that. This show did it and this show did it and this show did it. Like we are a patchwork of derivative art. But then I watched the first episode of Ted Lasso. It was super fucking good of the new season. And then I just watched Zoe Lister-Jones's indie film that she did during the pandemic, which is called How It Ends. Which like watching it, knowing it was like written, filmed and released all during the pandemic is wild. And it's like one of those really sort of small apocalypse movies where like everyone knows they're going to die at the end. And the girl she's walking around with is her younger self, but they just address it in the first 2 minutes. So like, well, clearly this is my younger self. And it's just like meta in the way that it approaches sort of an apocalyptic excavation of self. I like shit that's written for the writer nerds, like they acknowledge the writers that are watching and who are going to really love how nerdy of a flip on a convention it is. That's kind of where I'm at.
That's, I never realized I had a brand, but that's it. thank you all so much for chatting. This has been lovely. Please come back and talk to us anytime.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.